Standout with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Before we start the show this week, I want to take a minute or two to mention something that happened earlier last week. On Thursday, we heard the devastating news that the beautiful Lindsay Bennett sadly passed away after fighting her battle with cervical cancer since 2017. Kind, caring, brave, strong, beautiful and inspiring are just a few words I have seen people using as tributes continue to pour in as people pay their respects. I was lucky enough to interview Lindsay right here on my show just a couple of weeks ago. It's crazy sitting here in the studio knowing I was interviewing her in June. It's an interview that has a special place in my heart, and it's an interview that I got the biggest feedback from the listeners. Life is full of blessings we take for granted, yet so often we dwell on what we don't have. Appreciate what you already have and be grateful, because sometimes we don't appreciate what we have until they become the things we had. My thoughts and prayers are with Lindsay's family and friends, and most importantly, her two little girls, Zoe and Hayley. Rest in peace, Lindsay. Now, you're very welcome to the show tonight. I hope I find you well on this Wednesday evening. It's a miserable old few days out there with the rain and everything, so do you know what we call it? Typical Ireland weather. Hopefully this show will bring a bit of warmth to you and hopefully you enjoy it. Throw the feet up by the fire, turn on the radiator. I know, sure, we're all trying to save electricity and gas and everything these days, but sure, look, we'll drive on and hopefully I'll bring a bit of a smile to your face on this Wednesday evening. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week on Stand Out with myself, Ian O'Connell, is Damien Brown. A lot of you might know Damien from the rugby field playing rugby, but in recent weeks his name has been all over the news for a completely different reason. Damien became the first person ever to row from New York City all the way to Galway after 112 days at sea. Sit back and enjoy the show. Damien, thanks a million for coming on today.
Ian, thanks for the invite. It's a pleasure to be here.
With all my guests, I don't know if you've heard any of the interviews, but I like to bring them back to when they were growing up and to what it was like. You were mad into sports, I suppose. Where are you growing up?
Yeah, so I'm from Renmore, just on the way into Galway City, and it's pretty much a stone's throw from Galway's rugby club. So the estate where I live, kind of everyone was in and around 3 or 4 or 5 years of each other. So there used to be this kind of troop of young fellas kind of going up to Galwegians on a Saturday morning. So one of those Saturday mornings as an 11-year-old, I just found myself in that troop, and kind of, you could say, the rest is history. A couple hours later, I fully committed to a tackle, ended up getting the ball carrier's kind of trailing boot into my jaw, and felt this kind of reverberation of sensations through my nervous system, through my body, and just knew I'd found my sport. In that nanoseconds, you know, I loved everything about that, the commitment, full commitment to the tackle, the unknown of it, and the the sensations that for some people might not be a positive thing, but for me, for some reason, it just seemed to be. And and that was that. Then I kind of became obsessed with the sport of rugby, and thankfully, I suppose, and very gratefully, was able to make it my career for the start of my adult life.
And I suppose rowing, was that something at a young age you were into?
Believe it or not, it wasn't at all. I hadn't a scoobies about rowing or anything to do with rowing up until about 5 years ago. It was never so. I went to the Bish Secondary School in Galway City, and rowing actually was a big thing, and I had a couple of very close friends who were rowers, but I never had any kind of pull towards it. I was just so obsessed again by rugby, and that was kind of where all my focus went, you know, and I never even considered rowing until I saw a documentary by two English guys called James Cracknell and Ben Fogle, and they had rowed across the Atlantic, and I kind of, yeah, I just knew there and then watching that it was something I would like to try. But it was very much a case of post rugby, you know, post my career, I definitely was driven to get the absolute most out of my rugby career, and every kind of year I could, at least in every season I could, I wanted to continue that journey. But once that was over, that was something I wanted to do, which was row the Atlantic.
And you were saying about rugby there, you were capped by Ireland at under 21 level, were you?
That's right, yeah. Lucky enough to get caps at under 19, under 21, and then a couple other sides like development and A as well. Irish A went on a tour to North America called the Churchill Cup at the time. Honestly, it was a bit of a jolly. I don't think the rugby was too serious. Well, actually, I know the rugby wasn't too serious. It was one of the best social tours, if not the best social tour I was ever on. Just a great group of people. That was in 2006, and it was the end of a very long season. And yeah, we played three games out there, but it was more of a, like I said, more of a social thing. So that was my kind of the end of my Irish rugby representative days.
Was it 2001 then you got the contract with Connacht, was it?
Around that time, yeah, I was 20. I played my first game as 20, but I had been in the squad for a year or so before that. So, yeah, that was the start of, it was probably actually 90, probably 2000. And played there for 4 seasons before moving to the UK. I'm playing with Northampton for another 4 seasons. So Connacht was where it all started for me. Played all the representative stuff, and then was lucky enough to break into the senior team at a young age, you know, 19, 20, when there really wasn't that much competition, you know, because rugby was only professional at that point for about 5 years. There wasn't the depth of players in every position. So I was kind of, again, very fortunate to be almost fast-tracked into the system and to be playing, you know, major games at the time, at least major games for Connacht as a 19, 20-year-old, you know. So I kind of got an insight very early in my career into the demands of professional rugby.
Post-rugby then, your love for kind of extreme sports and stuff, I was reading on an article that you, when you were 12 or something, you crept away to climb cliffs somewhere. Was where did your love for that kind of stuff in extreme sports come?
Well, that story is a family heirloom at this point. we're up in Malinhead, and I went missing. We were just, you know, we were on family holidays, and we were just visiting, obviously, the attraction, if you want, and I just wanted a closer look at the actual tip of Ireland, you know, the northern tip of it. And Jesus, my dad is a very placid man. I've never seen him so bloody angry in my life, and I think it marked everyone, because he went from his usual placid self to, you know, fuming like. But so it comes from rugby, really, like, been kind of discovering the power of pushing my body and my mind, or the empowerment of it at least, and the rewards of that, living that way, you know. So when you are the person pushing yourself, when you are in control and you're able to kind of be disciplined and have a work ethic and have a level of I suppose a mindset of aggression and resilience, and one that is directed towards realizing your full potential and pursuing that. So that came, I learned that through the demands of rugby. Obviously the sport is highly pressurized, and then I took kind of responsibility for my own physical preparation in a big way within that pressurized environment, and was constantly looking for ways to improve as a rugby player and get the most out of myself. And you know, when I was living that way, it gave me great rewards. So it was clear to me that when I was going to retire, and I wanted to continue to pursue that way of living, you know, continually push my body and my mind to its perceived edges and beyond. So the kind of clear way for me to do that through my own passions and what was purposeful for me was becoming an extreme adventurer, because I'm very passionate about the planet and traveling around and seeing all the sights and sounds and smells and cultures and people and ingrating delving into those, and you know, giving myself a short but true window into what those cultures and people and their way of life is like. So you put those two things together, the drive to push myself and my body and my mind, and then the passion for traveling the planet and discovering every corner of it. The two of those things together kind of formed into that extreme adventure piece. So that's kind of where that drive to do extreme things comes from.
I'd be the same as you now. When, like, even when I'm on holidays and stuff, I love kind of seeing the different cultures and what they do, and even watching documentaries there on wildlife and stuff. I could watch them all day long. Now, you can contact me through the show today if you want to send me a message or anything. You can get through to me, as always, on Instagram at @EanO'Connell321 or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie.
Stand out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to the show. I hope you're enjoying the show so far, and it's an amazing story what Damien has accomplished and what he done over the 112 days at sea, because it's not every fella that sets out in the morning on a boat to go from New York City all the way to Galway. Do you know, when you were playing rugby, even for talking to you for the last 10 minutes, 15 minutes, I kind of get the impression you were obviously very driven and motivated. Would you have been, because I speak to a lot of people like that, and they're always their own biggest critic when they're playing. Are you hard on yourself, like, through your career or even now?
I'm very honest. And I think if you're honest with yourself, it's a very hard thing to be, because we almost have biases to not be have that kind of brutal honesty with ourselves. But I find it's a very empowered place to function out of and to live out of, and it serves me very well. So that means sometimes that I have to be very hard on myself, and sometimes I don't have to be very hard on myself. You know, if I uphold my standards and live to my values and practice those values and embody my philosophies that I have, well, then I can sit back and bask in the effort and the success of that. And that's kind of where I find myself at right now, because coming off the last expedition, I lived the way I wanted to live, and I was the person I strive to be, and that means that I can, you know, on a very unconscious level, I'm very happy and content with the way it all went. But sometimes to find that place, you have to be really hard on yourself. And I do have times where, you know, I don't take my own shit, you know, and there's plenty of times where it comes up, you know, the kind of more insecure, weaker side of yourself that just wants it easy and wants to take a day off. And I'm like, not today. I'm not adhering to that. I'm not letting the foot off the gas. And it's important to be able to recognize that and then to work against it.
And I think it's a great way to be honest with yourself. And like you said, it's the reward you get then at the end of whatever you do strive for. I know your name obviously has been in the news for the rowing across from New York and stuff lately, but I wanted to touch on a few things before that, even like stuff that people mightn't have heard of, as much as the recent adventure you've done. You've done a kind of a marathon in the Sahara Desert. They're going back a while. Do you want to tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So it's a thing called the Marathon des Sables, which means the Marathon of the Dunes. And it's based in the Sahara Desert. It happens every year. It's kind of like one of the original ultramarathons. So it's roughly 250 kilometers over 6 days. And that kind of translates into the equivalent of six marathons over 6 days, even though that's not the way they set it out. Basically, every year it's kind of a very similar framework, only the stages are different routes. But it's the first 3 days are kind of below a marathon length, you know, maybe 4, 5, 6 kilometers, and then stage four is always a double marathon. So it's like whatever that is, 52.53.6 or 2 miles or 80 something kilometers. And then the fifth stage is always a marathon length, and then the sixth stage is always a kind of a very short charity stage. So basically it's really over 5 days, and it's known as the world's toughest foot race. Now, it's probably not, no, it's definitely not, because you know, it's 36 years old this year, so there's lots of things. You know, typically humans are always looking for more, right? And in that 36 years that the Marathon des Sables has been about, there's races that have been conceived and are now run that are much more difficult. But they got in there really early with that marketing piece, and they call themselves the world's toughest foot race. And that's not to say it isn't hard. Of course it is very hard. So basically, from the very first day, the minute as you stand on the start line, you have everything on your back to survive the whole 6 days. So all your food, all your cooking utensils, all your bedding, all your clothes, and anything else you need for the 6 days, and that's in a backpack. And then they give you water the race, the MDS, the Marathon des Sables, they give you water every day. Every checkpoint, and there's a number of checkpoints in each stage for every day stage. And you know, you're talking about my year, at least I think it hit about 45, 46 degrees. It's normally run around April time. So it's not the height of summer, but still, you know, I think they run at that time of year because it's safer. But I have heard that it has hit, you know, 50 plus degrees some years. But the year I did it, which was 2016, we got to about 45, 46 degrees. So still no joke, right? And roughly about 1,100, 1,200 people started every year. And again, very roughly about 900, 950 finished. So there's always a kind of pretty significant dropout rate. And you sleep in a Berber tent every night, which they do something really cool in that race, actually, where they put the nationalities. So they put all the English in tents together, they put all the Irish in tents together, all the Americans in tents together. So, you know, the Irish sense of humor, it's very self-deprecating, you know, and when you're going through something really difficult like that, it couldn't be better suited to the situation. So we had some laugh in our tent, you know, just kind of, you know, slagging each other through the misery we were going through, and it was great to do that with fellow kind of countrymen. So yeah, it was a really good experience, and something that, you know, it mightn't be the last time I do it.
So it's unreal, unreal numbers, like you said, meeting up with the Irish in the same tent. It probably didn't make it easier, but kind of just the Irish humor made it a bit more easy flowing. Speaking of other stuff, you've done 5 of the 7 summits of the world, did you?
That's right, yeah. So the 7 summits is a it's kind of a well-known mountaineering feat where people try and climb the highest mountain on each continent, you know, the 7 continents. So currently, so I set out to do all 7 and I've attempted 6. I've summited 5. So I summited firstly Kilimanjaro, which is Africa's highest, Elbrus, which is Europe's highest, it's in Russia, and then the two North and South American mountains, Aconcagua and Denali, and then I did one in Western Papa, which is basically the oceanic continent's highest mountain. It's called Karsten's Pyramid. It's in the depths of this island, so you have the Papua New Guinea islands, but the western half of that, it belongs to Indonesia, and it's very remote. And I did that a few years ago, but it's not a particularly taxing mountain. It's the most technical in terms of actually the climbing that goes on, but it's not. It's only like 2 or 3 days. And then last year I attempted Mount Everest, but it was during the height of the Delta variant of COVID. Really? And obviously that, yeah, so, and that originated in India, if you remember, and Nepal has open borders with India, so as this thing was going around like wildfire in India, the Indian people were flooding into Nepal, so then it got into Nepal in a big way, and eventually, you know, found, because it was so contagious, found its way up to base camp. Because like base camp at Everest is like an anthill, you know, there's people coming and going constantly every day. There's porters, there's guides, there's climbers, there's people bringing in supplies that have to be kind of, you know, that are on yaks and donkeys, and then you have helicopters coming and going. So it's this kind of moving
like a village.
It's like a village, yeah, exactly that. There's 1,000 people there. So COVID got in, and I ended up getting COVID while I was there. So as you can imagine, a respiratory illness at 5,300 meters above sea level is far from ideal. I and some of my teammates got evacuated back to Kathmandu when we tested positive, got sequestered in a hotel for 10 days, eventually overcame the COVID and tested negative and flew back to base camp. But I was in a pretty compromised place, you know. I was still recovering from the illness, and you know, even though I did a rotation up to camp 2, so up to about 6,600 meters on the mountain, I really struggled. I was in a I just had no energy. Like, I never felt fatigued like it. It was just incredible, like the depths of the fatigue that coursed through me. And it would take me, you know, I as we were climbing through, say, some of the glacier, and we'd have to glacier points, and we'd have to go up a kind of steep ladder or some steep lines, when I'd get to the top, it would take me about 20 minutes to recover. I'd have to sit down and just slowly try and control my breathing, because I'd feel so fatigued, you know. But yeah, so I did my rotation, came back down to base camp, and you know, I wasn't feeling very confident, but I just thought if I give myself some time to recover and acclimate a little bit better and let the remnants of COVID leave me, at least I'll give it a go, you know. I'll try to get to the top. And about 7 or 8 or 9 days passed, and I started to build a little bit of confidence, started to feel a bit stronger, started to recover, started to regain some of my capacities, and, you know, went on a few hikes around base camp up to like 6,000 meters and felt pretty good. And, you know, I was like, right, well, you know, at least I'll give this thing a go. And we were ready to leave on our summit rotation. So normally it takes about 5 days to go from base camp to summit of Everest and then come back.
That so just puts it into perspective how big it actually is, doesn't it?
Yeah, no, it's really is monstrous, like. And yeah, I was ready to go with my Sherpa, and we were kind of geared up, and all that nervous energy was flowing through me, and it was like game day, right, let's go, let's give this the best shot possible at least. And we literally got a tap on the shoulder just before we were about to leave. Lad, sorry to tell you, but we just talked to the head Sherpa at Camp 2 and Camp 4, and everybody up there is testing positive for COVID. So we're pulling them all off the mountain. We're going to retest everyone down here at base camp. And basically, they did that. And 2 days later, they closed down the expedition. Yeah, 95% of the Sherpa had COVID. So, you know, you couldn't risk them. And that was it. Yeah, went home with my kind of lots of regrets, I suppose. But yeah, the mountain's not going anywhere and I might get another chance at it.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell. I'm here today with Damian Brown. I'll move on to the latest adventure and the one that everybody has been keeping an eye on all the time. You were, you know, at sea and everything. Do you want to tell me a bit about the latest adventure going from New York to Galway, and how did it actually come to fruition? How did you think of doing it?
So that was actually my second ocean row. And I did one, the first one I did was a solo ocean row from the Canary Islands to Antigua. And that was part of a race that happens annually called the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge. And in that race, there's boats from all the way from 5-person boats down to solos. And I was one of 5 solos in that race. It was about 30-odd boats. And I got to the other side. It took 63 days. And it was an amazing experience, very challenging. But within that race, there was another boat of 4 people from Antigua, the small little island in the Caribbean. So when I arrived into Antigua, it was a great, you know, celebrations. And I did something similar as I did with this row. I shared kind of clips on my social media, so people were able to follow it. And, you know, it was a nice buzz. And when I arrived, there was still a very strong remnants of the impact that 4-person boat from Antigua had on its country. Like, everybody I met was talking about the 4 guys that had, like, they arrived about 30 days before me, because obviously they're 4 and they had a fast boat and all that. So I started to think, like, okay, so, like, I saw that amazing impact they had, and I knew that you can row, like, the Atlantic the other way, the other direction. Now, it was much more challenging, much more difficult. But I thought, like, Jesus, I could actually row into my hometown here. Like, that's actually a possibility. You know, and there's very few people. Firstly, there's very few oceans that can be rowed in a certain direction, right, because of weather conditions. And the power of an ocean rowing boat is so minimal, you know, that you just won't be able to work against certain winds or certain currents. But Galway and the west coast of Ireland is actually possible. Now, it's very, very difficult, but it's possible. So that's kind of where the seed came from. And then I started working on it more and researching it more and realizing that as that research went on, it kind of grew into more of a purpose rather than a project, if you get me. Like, so I just became very passionate, and it had a lot of meaning for me to achieve this, bring about, firstly, this attempt, and secondly, achieve what I wanted to achieve, which was row from New York to Galway. And why New York? Because the very first ocean row ever attempted was 2 Norwegians that left New York and landed in this very south of the UK called the Scilly Isles. So there was almost a nod, I suppose, to the historical forebearers of ocean rowing in that, because New York is actually the hardest place you can leave from on that east coast of America or Canada. Like, you can go, you know, up to Newfoundland and Nova Scotia and leave from there, and it cuts out about 1,000 kilometers of the row. But, you know, I'm very much of the mindset that the harder the better. You know, the harder it is, the deeper you have to dig, the more challenge you have to go through, the greater the
better
rewards.
The reward would be then at the end.
Exactly that. So it made perfect sense for me to write New York to Galway, and it's basically one of the hard, like, you know, on a very broad level, you could say it's one of the hardest challenges on the planet. So perfect, let's go with that.
Crazy even to think about it. You left with a guy, Fergus, was it?
That's
and
right.
He had to drop out not too long into. Did it even cross your mind to say, right, I'm gonna go with him and not do it?
Didn't even cross my mind. A few people said it to me, you know, through text message, and that when we put it out there that Gus, he was off the boat, and I was like, oh yeah, no, didn't even occur to me. I was very, you know, coming back to the whole meaning and purpose behind the expedition, I was very driven to make it happen. I had prepared very diligently and in a very kind of extreme way to be ready and prepared to make it happen. And my whole mindset was like, nothing within my control is going to stop me getting across this ocean. So I said that to myself many, many times as I went across, almost kind of reaffirming the mindset to myself, because there was plenty of doubts. You know, it got really, really dark and negative and hard at times. And, you know, you got to be able to bring yourself back to, you know, a positive, at least a self-talk that is empowering. And that's just what I kept saying to myself. So yeah, no, I never registered when Gussie had to leave that I would leave too.
Never crossed the mind. I'm fascinated by the boat itself. I wanted to ask you about, you can see in the boat there's like two kind of, I suppose, mini cabins, you could say. What was the sleeping situation like, and what would it be like if there was a bad storm? Would you just go into the cabin or like sleeping? How was it?
Yeah, so as you said, there's two cabins. One of them is your main cabin, where you have your, like, the bed. So basically the whole inside of that cabin is like a vinyl, kind of thick vinyl mattress, and that's where you kind of just bed down and sleep when given time. And then you have all your electrics in there as well, and your desalinating unit, you know, so you have a unit on board that sucks up the seawater and runs through a load of filters and gives you drinkable water.
Really?
Yeah, because if you think about it, like, water is heavy, right? And you couldn't really fill the boat with water because it'd just be way too heavy to row. So you need this unit on board that'll give me about 6 liters of water in an hour when you put it on.
At least you'll never run out of water.
No, exactly. So that you can imagine the importance of that unit, like that, you know, that it stays, it doesn't break, and it doesn't malfunction, you know, because otherwise you're in big trouble. Otherwise, like, we have backups. Like, we would have been able to manually, they call it make water, we would have been able to manually make water, but that means that when you're meant to be resting, they have to be pumping this unit to create the drinkable water. So that would have been a nightmare, but thankfully the desalinator worked the whole way across. So yeah, and within there you have, like I said, all your electrics as well, and that's where you sleep. And that's where both of us actually slept at the same time when we were on a thing called power anchor, which is like the anchor you use when the ocean is too deep to use a traditional ground anchor. And that's just a parachute that you attach to the boat, and it sits under the water and it holds about 2 tons of water within the parachute. So that stops you getting blown backwards too far when you're in like a big kind of headwind or even a storm. But what that means is both people have to be in the cabin, and it is particularly small. So when both people are in there, you're basically lying on top of each other. Like, you know, it's that small. So as a one person, it's fine. You know, it's small, but it's manageable. When both people are in there, it's particularly uncomfortable. And it's particularly uncomfortable for a couple of reasons. Okay, the space is very small and you're touching each other, and the boat's getting knocked around, so you're constantly getting knocked around as well together. But also the cabin hatches have to be closed because you can't get any water in there. And that first kind of month or 6 weeks, it was really hot because it was summer, right, at lower latitudes. So inside that cabin, there's no airflow because the cabin hatches are shut, it gets to about 40 degrees. So the two of you are on top of each other, there's no airflow and it's about 40 degrees. Like, so it's really claustrophobic and you're trying to sleep and you could be in there. I think me and Gussie spent 13, 14 hours in there together. Like, so it's no fun. No fun at all.
Stand Out with Ian O'Connell on Radio Kerry.
Now, you're very welcome back to Stand Out with me, Ian O'Connell. I hope you're all enjoying the show so far. I'm here with Damian Brown. I know, obviously, physically demanding, but I'm sure it was even more mentally demanding than physically at times. Did you feel that when you were sharing your journey on social media? Did you kind of feel that you had company with you in, like, I don't know how to describe it, but did you feel like you weren't alone, that there was loads of people following you and you were able to communicate with them?
Yeah, like it's an outlet, right? To as you said, you're communicating with somebody when you do that. So it's, rather than, if you think about the opposite to that, it's just been alone and really not saying any words for months. Like, you know, you might talk to yourself a little bit, you might sing or something, but you wouldn't say much. Like, so this was a way for me to kind of get out the frustration and the angst and the story that was unfolding and the truth and the reality of that, and that's cathartic, you know, so that helped a lot. I also gave myself, so we had a project phone, you know, and that was the thing we were recording all our videos on, and the it was linked up to a system where a broadband satellite uplink where we could then send it back through WhatsApp. But I also gave myself the little kind of, what would you say, is it a treat maybe, of having the Instagram app on the phone. So every now and again, I would just click in and see, like, I didn't post anything. Somebody else was doing all the posting and all that sort of stuff. All I was doing was recording and writing the caption and telling the story. But every now and again, I'd click in and read some of the comments. And that helped a lot. It was like a dopamine hit, you know, a little uplift, you know, when you'd see what people were saying and that. So that was something that I hadn't done before, which kind of worked well this time.
And I don't know how to pronounce it, but I've heard you say in interviews, is that Nocturnal Miles or...
What's that?
Nocturnal Miles or something. I don't know how to pronounce it. What? It's kind of the word you'd use for miles out at sea. How many miles exactly did you cover for the whole thing?
Oh, nautical miles.
That's it, yeah.
Yeah, I covered, I think people are telling me, 3,450 nautical miles. So a nautical mile is 1.1 ground land miles, so whatever that works out at, probably 3,800 miles and 5,400 kilometers, something like that. Yeah, a long way, right?
I'm tired listening to you. What was the feeling when you spotted, was it Skellig Michael or even the coast of Ireland? That must have been unbelievable. What was going through your head?
I wasn't expecting it because I'd been on power anchor for that point for 4 days and been blown. There was these north westerly winds that were blowing me southeast. So at one point I was like 200 kilometers from Ireland, but over the course of that 4 days, I was blown away from Galway, but I was still been blown towards Ireland. So, you know, I woke up that morning and I the first thing I do is check the conditions to see if I can pull in the power anchor. And when I went out, I was like, is that land? And sure enough, because you have it was like dawn, right? So it's just a change of from dark to light, and you're kind of trying to make out between the low cloud cover, is that, and behind it you could see the sun kind of rising. And then you could see the outline of Skellig Michael. And then on closer inspection, a bit to the north, I could see the Kerry coast. And I was like, man, land, finally. Beautiful, beautiful. And what a thing for the first piece of land for you to see, like Skellig Michael. And it's iconic, you know. So, yeah, that was just an amazing moment. And very relieved, but also it's still land, right? And it's actually a threat in a way, like, you know, because now you're close to something that you can actually hit.
Yeah.
So you got to be, as well as relieved, you also got to be vigilant and start to, you know, make kind of decisions based on that piece of information that, okay, it's land, but like, I got to get north here. And I remember I had, I think, 30 hours of good weather before this, there was a, I think it was a yellow or orange weather warning came in with where there was force 8 and force 9 winds. So that meant I was going to have to go back on power anchor. So what I had to do was get as far north in that 30 miles as I could. And I remember at one point only been about 8 nautical miles from Valentia. And like, that's not good news. Like, when you're only 8 miles and you have force 8, force 9 winds coming in, you know, a matter of hours. So I had to get as far north as I could. I had to get past that Dingle Peninsula and try and get into a space where I had a bit more room to maneuver. So if I was blown towards Ireland, which was going to happen, at least there wasn't, you know, the tip of the peninsula. At least I could kind of go north of the peninsula and further in towards Finnish. And that's the way it worked out, thankfully. But it took a lot of work to get to that point.
Unrolled. All I can say is fair play to you. It's it's some achievement then. And I appreciate you coming on today now to tell me, because I know I was saying to the lads inside and working, and they were delighted to hear they were coming on. So thanks a million for coming on today, Damien.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, unfortunately, that's all we have time for tonight. I hope you all enjoyed the show, and I appreciate you tuning in as always. A massive thanks to Damien Brown for coming on today and having a chat about his story. And it's truly remarkable what he achieved, going from New York City all the way over to Galway on a boat. It begs beyond belief, really, to think that he done it. Imagine the waves and the tough nights away from family and missing occasions, birthdays and everything. So it was definitely a tough task, as you can tell, like, from his own story, the way he's telling it, that he did have his own tough time. So big up to him for doing that, and it's unbelievable what he achieved. You can contact me through my Instagram, enoconnell321, or through my email address, ioconnell@radiokerry.ie. I'll be back at the same time next Wednesday night from 8 to 9pm. Until then, stay safe and mind yourself.
You're tuned to the Kingdom's favourite radio station, on FM, online and on your mobile. This is Radio Kerry.